This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth. It's Wednesday, the 30th of April, and this is your BizNews briefing. I'm Malik Hogg. Well, earlier today, I caught up with the recently appointed head of the Freedom Front Plus, Corné Mulder. He became leader just 2 months ago, and he, well, has had a pretty interesting time of it, the Freedom Front Plus being part of the Government of National Unity. I wanted to get his thoughts on the current political fracas and where we might be going from there. And actually, it's very interesting the way he unpacked it. Where we are is largely the result of a constitution that was written not with what the system is that we have today. In other words, there was no idea when the constitution was written back in the early or the mid-1990s that there would be a coalition government in South Africa, or indeed that one political party or the ANC would have less than 50%. That's why it was almost an afterthought. Well, if it happens, you've got 14 days to put this together. Coalitions take a heck of a lot longer to put together, and Corné Mulder actually explains it all to us in this little clip from our interview. The full interview is on BizNews TV.
We were forced in June of last year to put a government together within 14 days, which is completely almost impossible. So what happened in those 14 days, it was basically negotiated between the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. After they negotiated the Declaration of Intent, it was basically produced and given to the other parties to say, well, can you live with this? If you can, sign it. But it was a quick thing to put a government together, which basically resulted in the election of the president on the 14th of June. He then appointed the executive. What's unfortunate was what we basically need in this kind of government of national unity is an absolutely negotiated, agreed upon new program of government in detail in terms of exactly what are we going to do, this is how we're going to do that, and then that program becomes a program of a government of national unity. We don't have that. We have broad outline. And then it was said basically we're going to have a national dialogue where these things will be slogged out. Well, it's now almost a year we have not had the government, the national dialogue. I know there are some steps taken to have a meeting. There was supposed to be the first meeting in April. It didn't take place. They're aiming for June, and maybe it will only happen next year.
If South Africa was one giant business, South Africa Inc., then you guys are our board of directors. The Government of National Unity is our board of directors. If you have a business that's in crisis, that board of directors gets together urgently, finds out what to do urgently, or it gets replaced because the shareholders will kick them out and get another board of directors who can fix it. In South Africa, we have an urgent situation. That IMF says we're going to grow at 1% this year. We haven't grown at more than the population growth rate now for over a decade and a half. That is like serious crisis because your shareholders are getting poorer and poorer. Your share price is falling all the time. I want to try and translate that into politics. And why is it that you said a moment ago there should have been a meeting in April, now it will be in June, and maybe only next year? That does not show much urgency from our board of directors of South Africa Inc.
That would be the case. You're right, Alec. That would be the case if the decisions to be taken by the board of directors, being the government, depends on the outcome of the national dialogue. Now, originally, when the Declaration of Intent was negotiated, we were under the impression that that was the idea, that the Board of Directors of South Africa cannot function until they get guidance through a national dialogue. It became clear in the last 12 months that's not going to be the case, that the Board of Directors believe that they know and they think they can take the company forward. But there's also this national dialogue, which is basically almost a consultation process. It's almost a public participation process with the shareholders, which is good, which is very important. I think we need to do that and touch base with the shareholders of South Africa Inc. But the fact of the matter is the board of directors know exactly what needs to be done, and they should do that. And I think the balance of power in terms of the structure within the board may be problematic. In other words, I would see that the directors should get around the table being on an equal footing, all acting in the best interest of the company. But at the moment, it's a little bit of a disproportionate kind of thing where you've got the president and other people within the board of directors within the company. Well, that may be so, and the president is the president, and obviously we respect that. But then the president, as the CEO of a company, should actually take the lead, get the board of directors together and say, listen, we've got this crisis. Let's deal with it. How are we going to take this company forward now with absolute urgency? And that kind of urgency, as far as I'm concerned, lacks, because it may be, just may be, that the CEO is in charge, believes that the previous policies of the company are sufficient to get us out of this problem. While all indications are that the previous policies or decisions implemented by the previous board of directors have brought us to this crisis where we don't have economic growth, where we don't have job creation, with all those kind of problems. There needs to be an understanding that the government, the company, the board of directors needs to steer the company in a different direction. And that needs to be done. And I don't think there's necessarily the appetite for that. But I think the reality on the board, on the ground, indicates that if we don't do that, the shareholders will kick the board out sooner than later.
We covered a lot of ground this morning, and part of it was the tension that is going on between the White House and the union buildings. And I asked Dr. Mulder if there was any light at the end of what seems to those of us outside to be a very dark tunnel.
I definitely think so. I think we must understand that the Trump administration is serious in their positioning in terms of not only South Africa, but internationally, by putting the United States first. And if you look at what the approach would be in terms of tariffs, et cetera, et cetera, Mr. Trump is a very strategic chess player. He came with the tariffs. He immediately went back on his word to a certain extent, or in terms of a negotiating strategy. South Africa must understand that the United States is very serious in their dealing with South Africa, and they are not impressed. And to a very large extent, there's a number of issues being on the table creating this problem. The way that the ANC is behaving in terms of international policy. And I think the most serious blunder by the ANC basically was the court case against Israel. They overstepped the mark there by championing this cause on behalf of Iran and some of the other rogues in the world, pointing all fingers at Israel and nothing with regard to Hamas. That were a very stupid decision with all due regard, and we are paying a price. But I am honestly believing that we will have a constructive and a positive relationship with the United States if certain things are put on the table, if certain amendments are made, and it can be done. I think the Trump administration would be only too welcome to reach out to South Africa. We can negotiate a much better deal, even better than AGOA, if we do the right things.
Interesting discussion indeed from the man who's been described as often the only adult in the room, where politicians appear to be bickering like preschoolers. Well, on to Donald Trump, the man who featured in that second part of, or the second clip that we picked up for you from the Corne Mulder interview. And he was in fine form yesterday in the United States, in the state of Michigan, where he celebrated his first 100 days in office. Let's have a look at the Donald.
We're ending the inflation nightmare, the worst that we've had probably in the history of our country, getting woke lunacy and transgender insanity the hell out of our government. We're stopping the indoctrination of our children, slashing billions and billions of dollars of waste, fraud, and abuse. And above all, we're saving the American dream. We're making America great again, and it's happening fast, too. What the world has witnessed in the past 14 weeks is a revolution of common sense. That's all it is, really. We're conservative. You're conservative, you're liberal, whatever the hell. You know what it's all about? It's about common sense when you think about it. We're for common sense. We like strong borders. We like good education. We like low interest rates. We like being able to buy a beautiful car. And now deduct the interest on the loan. That's never happened before. We want a strong military. We want low taxes. You know, the Democrats, they campaign on, we will raise your taxes. It's the first time. You know, I haven't been doing this that long, actually, compared to a lot of people. They've been doing it for a long time. They say, you became president. I can't get out of Congress. Or some of them can't even get into Congress. But, you know, I haven't been doing it that long, but all my life I've been watching, and I've never heard people campaigning that they're going to raise taxes. It's always been, we will reduce your taxes, Democrat, Republican. Now they go, we're going to raise your taxes.
He's only got a turn of phrase. Quite interesting on the BizNews platform, though. R.W. Johnson is not a Trump fan. Rob Herseff, on the other hand, well, he's been fully supportive, and he had this to say about Trump's first 100 days in office.
Look at the man. I think he's living his best life. He's positive. He's happy. His team are absolutely in sync. And if we start at the border, he was elected on a number of issues, but one was closing the border. The border is now 90% closed. 10,000 people a day were pouring through the U.S. border under that useless Biden, and the border is closed. Now, Trump has still got to deal with the, I think it's 11 million or 12 million people that Biden let through the door that have spread out all over America, hiding out, applying for Social Security grants, cards, benefits. You know, that's a whole nother matter, and he's got to obviously deal with that. But the border is secure. In 100 days, he's done it. Second, let's look at the energy. On energy, there's no more net zero. Al Gore's been completely discredited, as he should be. You know, he's one of the greatest hoaxes that's been placed on humanity over the last 20 years. And, you know, Appalachian coal fields are being reopened, re-energized. There's continued increased fracking. The Americans are now sending LNG to Europe, which Europe desperately needs. The price of oil has come down. I think it's at $60 a barrel. And the energy market in America has never been in better shape. It's drill, baby, drill. And this re-energization of the energy market and dissing of the green nonsense has taken place in 100 days. It's extraordinary. And for people that worry about the strategic reserve, I believe the American strategic reserve is actually filling up. I don't have the detail on it, but I've heard that it's actually in much better shape. So third, DEI. DEI was just, you know, an issue that Donald hated. And he hates South Africa because South Africa is DEI in motion. And across America, DEI has been killed. And I was listening to a great podcast where somebody said it's like Rip Van Winkle, America. Everyone's woken up suddenly and go, what were we thinking? What were we thinking for DEI of putting a person's skin color ahead of merit? You know, it's exactly what Martin Luther King didn't want to happen. And under Obama and Biden, it was introduced. But it's been swept away in a meaningful way. And I mean, that's another incredible thing that Donald's done. And the law is on his side. You know, Donald Trump has the law on his side on DEI. Then we look at the stock market. I mean, the stock market's been very volatile. People panic. Oh, you know, Trump's killed the stock market. Well, the reality is that was true for probably a week, 10 days. It's come right back. So, you know, everyone panics. Look at the bond market. Look at the stock market. Well, guys, calm down. It's not 1 week by 1 week.
Very good point there about the stock market. We do have in the BizNews portfolios a lot of stocks that are listed in the United States of America. And at one point, they were sharply down, but they've recovered all of that ground now. So it is a vote of confidence, I guess, from long-term investors in what America is going to be in future. I'm always reminded whenever it comes to Donald Trump that a guy that I know quite well, who actually spends a lot of time in the United States and with Trump and those close to him, says, don't take him literally, but take him seriously. Well, Rob Herseff has also weighed in on what the new ambassador to South Africa from the United States should be doing in advising the White House on its relationship with the Union buildings. He also had some interesting words to propose to Donald Trump about how to deal with South Africa. Let's have a listen.
If you said to me, Rob, what message would you give to Brent Bozell, the ambassador in waiting, who I think will get confirmed relatively soon? Took quite a few months for the Israeli ambassador to Israel to be confirmed, but I think they're all going to be confirmed soonish. What is my message to him? And what is my message to Donald Trump? One, do not listen to South Africa. Have meetings. Accept any meetings with anyone until this government repeals EWC, drops the case against Israel and ICJ, and shows a real willingness to remove BEE. No discussions till then. Zero. Okay, not even on trade. Okay? Secondly, move the ambassador from Pretoria to Cape Town. Back the Western Cape. Remove all tariffs on the Western Cape, including on wine, any agricultural product for the Western Cape. Because the Western Cape has been run by the DA, and the DA has not been in favor of EWC, DEI, BEE, ICJ case. I think America should look at the Western Cape and say, you know, we're going to do everything we do into South Africa and Southern Africa through the Western Cape, through Cape Town. We're going to move our ambassador to Cape Town. Forget Pretoria. I'm not interested in talking to the ANC and those muffins. We'll talk to the DA. We'll make the DA our official mouthpiece of what we want to achieve, the benefits we want to give to South Africa, the things we want to see happen in South Africa that the DA has anyway been supporting. And I'd, you know, offer to refurbish Simonstown, but make it much more America-centric. I'd offer to do a massive investment in the port of Saldanha. Everything should be focused on supporting, enhancing the Western Cape. And anyone in the Western Cape, there'd be no tariffs to America, but slam tariffs on the rest of South Africa. Punish the bad guys, embolden the good guys, you know?
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec business banking, out of the ordinary.
Well, some interesting thoughts there from Rob Herzog. I would remind you that BizNews Premium's favorite columnist, R.W. Johnson, has got a completely different view. And that's what we're about. We're a platform that gives all sides, we hope, or as much as we can, of every story so that you can make up your mind. Another mind that needs to be made up, particularly in the United Kingdom, is on the British politician Nigel Farage. He was treated a dozen years ago as an oddity. Now he's a force to be reckoned with. Indeed, it is a... The latest polls in the UK are saying that the Reform Party is more popular than the Labour Party, which you might recall won a landslide victory in the last election, and the Conservative Party, who've got similar policies to Nigel Farage's Reform Party. The first real test comes tomorrow for Reform Party when Britons around the country vote in local elections. It's like our municipal elections. Matthew Holhouse, who is the British political correspondent for The Economist, went into rural England to find out how the Farage train is running so hot and continuing to gather incredible momentum and where it might end. Here's Matthew.
I've met Farage often over the years. At elections, at conferences, in the bar in the European Council building in Brussels, where he would hold court during summits, sticking the needle into whichever British Prime Minister was in town. He jokes in a rather old-fashioned way about the women in his life. And one of the things that is quite old-fashioned about him is that when he does a rally, he always gives interviews. All comers, from the Times of London to the Lincolnshire Echo. Nothing too much trouble.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's the
hello.
That's
how are you doing? All right.
Very true.
Yes, hello. Very nice to meet you. Yeah. All very good. I know the others.
Which you might think is normal for a politician. But for a party leader these days, it really is not.
Sod all changes, but the years go by. When it comes to the street walkabout stuff and popping in the bookies or doing whatever I do, they can't do it. They can't speak to ordinary people. They don't know what having fun is.
As he reminisced, I thought about what I'd seen earlier in the day in Doncaster. As the video played on the big screens, Farage, silent at the back of the room, the crowd turning to face him, stock still, impassive, imperious. Was that part of the performance too?
That moment when you walked on in Doncaster this morning,
yeah,
and you stood really, really still, and everyone turns around and looks at you.
Mm.
What is going through your head at that moment?
Look at the video. We're playing a video. Why are you looking at the video? Why are you looking at me? Well, a lot of people have put their faith in me. I mean, that's the brutal truth of it. So there is a weight, there is a burden of responsibility in that. People want leadership. People want someone to look up to, or a set of people to look up to. They just do. Humans always have. They always will.
That wasn't the answer I had expected. I thought he'd crack a joke, or talk about how he was trying to remember his lines. And I don't think that's what he would have said when I was writing about his rallies a decade ago. Back then, rivals would throw names at UKIP. Fruitcakes and loonies, cranks and gadflies. And Farage wore them as badges of pride. But here was a flash of seriousness. Those words, faith, leadership, someone to look up to. That moment in Doncaster now looked rather different, because those are the sorts of things that a person might say if they believe that they can become Prime Minister.
The world is really, really changing, and that podcast is highly recommended. It comes from a suite of podcasts that The Economist produces. That one is called The Intelligence, one of my favorites, and it comes out daily. And you'll find that on The Economist's website. The podcasts are free to air. You can go along and have a listen to them. He mentioned in there, did Matthew, that things have really changed a lot for Nigel Farage and for the Reform Party, but actually they've changed for the world. And we'll get a better insight into that now in our final clip of this edition of The Briefing, which comes from a man who's well known in South Africa, Dr. Mark Mobius. He's been visiting our shores for decades. He runs the biggest emerging market fund in the world. He's regarded as the guru of investing in emerging markets. And although he's getting on a bit, he's still very active. He spoke to our partners at Bloomberg this morning, a fairly lengthy interview from which I pulled some of the highlights, including that he has 95% of his funds in cash.
Talk to us about the psyche of the investor right now. Is it about fundamentals? Is it about, you know, keeping up with the headlines? How have things changed in the way markets think, in the way investors think?
Well, of course, as soon as Trump made the announcements regarding tariffs, the first thing he did, of course, was create this great uncertainty, and the market came down. We're looking at 20%, depending on what market you're looking at. Now, usually when you have a drop like that, people start thinking, oh, maybe we should start picking up a little bit, or at least not selling anymore. And I think we've reached this point now. The next step, of course, is to assess what comes next and where the opportunities are. Obviously, some companies are going to benefit from this tariff situation globally, and some will not. So what we're doing is looking at the whole picture globally and saying, okay, let's make an assessment of what we can expect going forward. And what that means, of course, is a total new way of looking at trade, looking at politics, and looking at economics.
What gives you the optimism this will pan out the way you're expecting?
Well, I think we have to be patient. We have to wait for the next 2, 3, 4 months to see how this all pans out. You know, one of the things you must remember with Trump, he is in a bargaining situation. He is trying this, trying that, threatening this, pulling back. So you're going to see more and more of this negotiation and bargaining taking place. And within the next, I would say, 4 to 6 months, this will all pan out, and we'll see a settling of what the agreements are going to be with various countries.
What in particular are you looking out for that will shape how you think, about where you place your money in the next few months?
at this stage, cash is king. So 95% of my money in the funds are in cash. We're playing a little bit with S&P 500 index funds just to keep a tune of the market, because the S&P is a leader globally. But we're also looking at some of the emerging market stocks, but in a very, very careful way. I think right now we've got to keep cash and be ready to move when the time is right.
But keeping 90% of your funds in cash, it's really, really high. That's possibly the highest I've heard so far. Why do that? Aren't there enough opportunities out there for you to be deploying your capital?
Well, when you're getting 4 or 5% with no risk in dollars, you're doing quite well. Of course, we're not going to hold that for the whole time. It's not going to be more than 3 to 4 months when we begin to do more, depending on where the market is. If the market comes down further, of course, we will be putting more money in.
And just a quick correction there. My apologies. He used to run the biggest emerging market fund in the world, the Franklin Templeton Emerging Market. Now, of course, he works for himself. Good for you, Mark. Well, that's been it from the team at BizNews. We'll be back again tomorrow when Bronwyn will be hosting the briefing. Until then, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.